I'm Cyndi Lauper with fellow Cosentyx advocate, Chef Michelle Bernstein.
We'll share our experiences with plaque psoriasis, with psoriatic arthritis, and Dr. Panico will talk about the possible connection.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for adults with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis 300 milligram dose and adults with active psoriatic arthritis 150 milligram dose. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for tuberculosis. An increased risk of infections and lowered ability to fight them may occur, like tuberculosis or other serious bacterial, fungal, or viral infections. Some are fatal. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if inflammatory bowel disease symptoms develop or worsen. Serious allergic reactions and severe eczema-like skin reactions may occur.
Learn more at 1-844-COSENTYX or cosentyx.com/Cyndi.
Welcome back to Listen to Your Heart. I'm Jerry.
And I'm Jerry's Heart.
Today's topic, Repatha, evolocumab. Heart, why'd you pick this one?
Well, Jerry, for people who have had a heart attack, like us, diet and exercise might not be enough to lower the risk of another one.
Okay.
To help know if we're at risk, we should be getting our LDL-C, our bad cholesterol, checked, and talking to our doctor.
I'm listening.
And if it's still too high, Repatha can be added to a statin to lower our LDL-C and our heart attack risk.
Guess it's time to ask about Repatha.
Do not take Repatha if you're allergic to it. Serious allergic reactions can occur. Get medical help right away if you have trouble breathing or swallowing, swelling of the face, lips, tongue, throat, or arms. Common side effects include runny nose, sore throat, common cold symptoms, flu or flu-like symptoms, back pain, high blood sugar, and redness, pain, or bruising at the injection site.
Listen to your heart.
Ask your doctor about Repatha. Learn more at Repatha.com or call 1-844-REPATHA.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
Dan O'Brien, though, is with me. Before any of that, the Chief Economist at the Institute of International and European Affairs, to talk a little bit about housing. And Dan, I'm conscious when we talk about housing on this show, we often focus on numbers, the numbers of things like housing for all targets, housing commission recommendations, the other housing targets that different bodies have recommended to government. We talk about planning permissions granted, about commencement notices, about completions. One of the numbers that we very rarely, if ever, talk about is the population of the country and how much that impacts housing. Is that something we should be paying more attention to?
I think it is at the moment, because since the beginning of 2002, we've had a big increase in the rate of growth of the population for various reasons. So that means there's bigger demand for housing. Now, this is somewhat of a fraught issue, because when people start talking about population growth, the next thing is it's mostly to do with immigration now. And then it becomes, are you blaming the immigrants for housing? Now, it's not a question of blame. It's a question of, if you have a lot of demand and we've been stuck on supply since the beginning of 2022, by coincidence, that we just haven't, the supply has been flat since 2022, beginning of 2022. So that means you do have to look at the demand side as well. So, as I say, most of our population growth now is because of immigration, and we give out a lot of permits to people to come and live here. And in many cases, that's very beneficial for the country. You get a software engineer who arrives here and goes to work on a Monday morning, starts paying taxes, lots of taxes, as you do if you're a software engineer in the tech industry. And that's good. But that person also has to find a place to live. So I think we do need to start talking about it. And not only do we need to start talking about it, but a little like Canada, which is the only country that's had a similar sort of population spike in the OECD as we have, to say we need to manage demand, which means we need to cut back a little, even if those work permits and permits we give out, study permits, are beneficial in some ways. They have downsides as well, and we need to start talking about that.
You're right. Like, people listening to this, they'll immediately start texting in talking about, you know, refugees and asylum seekers. How many permits do we issue on an annual basis? How does that compare to the number of people who come here claiming asylum? We'll set aside Ukrainians for the moment, because that was a kind of a one-off aberration,
absolutely,
we hope.
Absolutely. So that, the Ukraine factor was a big factor because about 100,000 Ukrainians came here, and that was a big, but as you say, it was a one-off factor. It's stabilised a lot since then, so that's not a big factor. We did, at the same time, and it's not quite clear to me why it was, but if you go all the way back, like the 2015 migration crisis in Europe, we had still well below, you know, per capita, we had well below the number of asylum seekers. So asylum was pretty small, was not an issue here, or it was a very small issue, and certainly very small relative to migration. So the number of asylum seekers relative to the number of people coming here with work permits, for example, was tiny. But that started to change in 2022. So we had a bump up in asylum applications since 2022 as well. So we had Ukraine, asylum applications, and then a lot more people coming to work. So all of those things combined means the population has, over the past 3 years, has grown. Now, the numbers are different because demographers have different estimates of it, but it's pretty clear that that's what's happened. But the idea that it's all down to asylum seekers, that's, you know, it's the issue that we can really control is, do we want more students coming here? As I say, there's upsides to students coming here, but they also need a place to live. And as a society, the issuing of permits to foreigners is how it benefits everyone who's here already. It's not, is it good for, you know, my wife's a Brazilian, and that we have more Brazilian people coming to learn English. That's great for Brazilian people coming to learn English, but are they bringing more to the party than they're taking out? And that's what the issuance issue is about. And in my view, I think we've got to the point where we need to start saying we need to give out fewer student visas. Even if those workers are adding and adding to the economy, they still need a house, and we've really got a housing problem.
Yeah.
So we need to start looking at, do we want to bring to look at managing the issuance of visas more? And everyone else is doing it now. The Canadians, you know, last year, the Canadians, as I say, they are the only OECD country that have had as big a spike over the past 3 years. And even the uber woke Justin Trudeau, or Pierre, is it Justin Trudeau, came out and said, look, we need to start managing the numbers. And nobody's going to accuse him of being anti-immigration or an anti-immigrant or a racist or anything like that.
Is there an argument that you end up robbing Peter to pay Paul when you think of the amount of people who come in, for example, to work in the health system on those types of visas?
Well, I suppose there are different areas. So, you know, the argument that most of the people who get visas are working is actually not true. So according to the most are other reasons. So your students, you will have a section from the asylum perspective. You'll have people who bring their kids and their partners or whatever. So the argument that it's all about employment, it's actually less. Well, like the last figure, it was only 1 in 4 of the people who were issued permits to stay here were workers. So, yes, and then look at the working component and say you've got to look at the people who are really needed. So health workers, of course, are a very big proportion of that, and they are needed. They're needed more than, say, people who get permits to work in slaughterhouses. So, you know, my view would be that at a time of a chronic housing shortage, that issuing work permits to low pay and low value added workers, again, is an area we need to examine.
There'd be people who work in third level education who would say, yeah, listen, in abstract terms, I'd absolutely agree. No issue with reducing the amount of foreign students we have. The reason we pursue them is because of underfunding. And that's how they make a lot of their money these days, is attracting students from abroad. So something absolutely would have to be done, wouldn't it, on that
absolutely
front?
Absolutely, absolutely. There's no doubt about it. People in the third level sector want all those foreign students to be given their visas because they pay a lot of money. People in the language school business want it because that's their business is based on. And of course, as I say, there are people who, you know, the third level sector businesses in the English language sector benefit from this. But we have to look at it in the round.
Yeah.
Does it add to demand for housing and make the situation more difficult? Don't forget, we're only building, we seem to be stuck at about 30,000 new units a year. Now, the population over the past 3 years has grown about 100,000 a year. Now, that those two numbers just don't work well together.
Yeah.
Now, it's pretty clear that we're not going to be able to get the supply up in the short term. You know, it's been, as I say, 3 years of stagnation. We're not going to suddenly get to 60,000 houses. So if we can't get to 60,000 houses, we need to start looking at how can we, without getting into sort of, you know, this is all a sort of, you know, highly fraught thing. It's just to say, look, there are upsides and downsides to migration.
Yeah.
Some types of migration are better for the existing population than other types. Let's just have a reasoned debate about managing
without
that.
Marching down O'Connell Street with the tricolour.
With the tricolour. Like, I'm not, you know, my wife's Brazilian. I spent most of my life as an immigrant in other countries, most of my adult life. You know, I don't wrap myself in the tricolour. But I think we can have a grown-up conversation. And, you know, those sort of people who want a pure, you know, ethnically pure country, you know, look, I don't agree with them. I think they're in the minority. But I think there's, you know, plenty of people who are concerned that we need to do more and we need to talk about the demand side as well as the supply side.
Did we manage, though, to crack this nut at one point in the past? And I'm just thinking of the years in the wake of the eastward expansion of the European Union, when we did have a big influx in population and we there was a corresponding increase in house building. So we had a big hike in demand and we managed the supply side.
Yeah, well, nobody advocates going back there. Because, well, we had more people, but we had a lot more capital and we had all that money flowing in and it went to the wrong places and it caused a banking crisis. So don't forget, the reason we have built so many houses in those years up to 2008 was because banks and financiers and bond issuers were literally throwing money in the belief that it was going to there would be money made forever. We don't want to go back there because we don't want another banking crash.
Yeah, okay. But did it display a capability to meet a big increase in demand?
It displayed a belief that there was so much money to be made in building houses that you could borrow and throw any amount of money at it.
Okay.
Which, again, you know, is it profitable? One of the reasons we're stuck at sort of 30,000 a year is because the cost of building has gone up with inflationary pressures post-COVID. Interest rates have gone up, which means the adds to costs as well. So all of these things, in some cases, make building, particularly in Dublin, unprofitable.
So that one of the conditions has changed from kind of the mid-noughties to now, which is the finance model, well, a few conditions, but all to do with money. The finance model, the credit available, and the cost of building.
Yeah, all of those things. A lot of moving parts to this, Kieran. You know, always is. But a lot of things have changed. But what we clearly know is that we're stuck on the supply side.
When did that moment where we plateaued, kind of post-22, is that a post-COVID thing or an inflation thing or both?
I think it's a combination of increase, because the inflation thing began in 21.
Yeah.
Interest rates then started to go up. So you had inflation raising the cost of building materials. You had interest rates raising the cost of financing, and those both happening at the same time. So they were certainly factors involved. Also, we sort of hit full employment. Where were you going to get the extra workers? So we have, whatever the reasons, and I say that there are many, you know, cogs in this piece, but we are stuck over 3 years on the amount of houses we're building. And whatever anyone does, whatever policies are implemented, that's just not going to change in the short term. We're not going to get up to 60,000 houses next year. And if we're not going to be able to manage on the supply side, regardless of what anybody wants or what anybody does, we're going to have to start looking at the demand side.
One listener says, this is one of the first serious debates that highlights housing demand as a driver of the crisis. The recent CSO report shows that non-EU migration has increased hugely in recent years. It has to be a factor. Most of these are legal. They're based on new work and student visas, but we need to match the issuance of visas to somehow match housing supply. But Dan, there's no escaping it. Somebody else says, for shame, I can't believe what I'm hearing. The migrants have never been the problem.
Again, it's not a blame issue, Kieran. And I know that you're not looking to put it in that way.
No.
And I'm not. My wife's a migrant. You know, it's not about blame. It's about lots of people coming to live here for their own reasons, and many of them have good reasons to be here and are contributing in many ways. Many of them are actually putting far more in. If you look at those tech engineers,
yep,
they land on a weekend, they're paying big taxes on Monday morning, and they are contributing more than they're taking out, and they'll go in a few years and whatever. But they still need a place to live.
Yeah.
And we've got to think about that without having an hysterical thing that, you know, the far right's about to take over and we're about to become Nazi Germany.
Dan O'Brien, Chief Economist at the Institute of International and European Affairs. Dan, thanks a million for coming
thanks
in to
sir.
Us.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.
Comcast is committed to bringing access to the internet to all Americans, including rural communities across the country, like Sussex County, Delaware.
We were being left behind. Everybody around us seemed to have internet, but we did not. high-speed internet is one of those good things that we needed to help us move our farming, our small businesses, our recreation forward.
Learn more about how we're bringing our next generation network to more people across the country at comcastcorporation.com/investmentinamerica.